So the question is, how much emphasis, how much allocation of resources do you put on each? But what didn't happen, as we'll see subsequently in next week's lecture, is that the strategic thinking did tilt back toward political Dao Chun, and it was Trung Chin's turn at bat after the Winter Spring Offensive. That was probably part of the deal that was made that Jop used. If this doesn't work, we'll try it your way. Probably what the price he had to pay in to get Trung Chin's support to begin with. Anyway, there was a great deal. The perception in the United States, I think, I was in Hong Kong at the during Tet 68, where my family was living. Everybody was out of town practically. We all left because we knew there wouldn't be anything happening at Tet. Tet was a very sacred holiday, and there'd never been an attack made by the communists during Tet Offensive. Used to scare people, Americans, military particularly, when they first came to Vietnam. Scared me, I think, the first time, the first Tet, where there's just this stand down, and the place is just wide open, and you think, boy, they could really hit us if they wanted to. But they didn't. And year after year after year, you say the same thing. So the newcomers come in and say, boy, this is very dangerous. Oh, don't worry about it. There won't be any trouble. And there wasn't any trouble. So I think for 8 years, Jop cultivated us to think exactly this. He was going to only use this once, and this was the time. Anyway, I was in Hong Kong when the balloon went up, and so it took me 2 days to get back to Vietnam. Tan Son Nhut, the airfield was closed, so anyway, I was on the first plane that landed at Tan Son Nhut, and I had instructions from the ambassador to come down, Ambassador Bunker, to see him immediately, and he said, I've got to have some kind of a talking paper, and I'm going to have a press conference, I'm going on ABC television, and I've got to have something that will I can use to explain what this is all about. He wanted what he wanted from me was the other side's view. He didn't want the whole thing. He just, how does Hanoi see this? What's all going down here and so on? Well, the intelligence on this had, on the Winter Spring Offensive, had been very good from mid 67 on. We were getting all kinds of reports on this, and they tracked it fairly carefully, and you knew, there's a voluminous amount of material that of this sort of thing, the three stages. Well, Jop had outlined it in a book, so it wasn't all that hard to come by. Anybody could have it if they wanted. It was very esoteric, as I'm sure some of this strikes you, but it was all there, particularly if you had the benefit in hindsight. So one question was, was this an intelligence failure? Was it unexpected? So I said to Bunker, what I need then is all the reports and everything that we've gotten here on this, predicting this thing for the last 6 months. So he gave the order that I get this to the three or four intelligence communities. And this is very hard to come by. Usually if you're not in the intelligence community, you can never get that kind of stuff. But once in a while, the guy on top will order you to get it and give it to somebody who probably will know if you're not giving them everything, and that can cause them big trouble. So I had a stack of reports about that high. And I sat down, and I remember at 11 o'clock in the morning, and I started going through these one by one and putting them into three piles. One pile was any report that suggested that this Tet Offensive, that centerpiece, was going to come. And the second pile was things that did not suggest that it was going to come. Now I had the benefit of hindsight. I knew what happened. So then I would go through and see, did whoever write this or whatever report they were working on see things happening or not. And then I went through the second pile and divided it into sort of those that were probable and those that were not. So I had a not, probable, and certain. And the certain pile, there was just one one piece of paper there, one report, in which the analyst had said, my expectation is that the Viet Cong will launch a major attack on all the centers, population centers in South Vietnam, and they will do it at an anniversary when the stand down is greatest. And I expect that this will come at Christmas, 67. And I went around to see him. I said, boy, you were right on the money, except you had the wrong date. He said, don't I know it? And I said, did they take you seriously? He said, well, yeah, actually, Westmoreland took this fairly seriously. He was a very cautious guy. He ordered some, a certain amount of augmentation and, you know, extra guards and so on. But he said, then Christmas came and went, and I had egg in my face. And I said, God, if you'd only picked the other anniversary, the next anniversary coming down the road, you'd be a legend today. The point is that all of the material there, a lot of it suggested this. I mean, at least half of this pile suggested. So it was not a failure in analysis, I mean, a failure in intelligence. What there was a failure in was in the analysis to make the final leap to, I mean, there were constant reports of hundreds of them, but intelligence reports that they're moving small arms caches into the Wei area, that there's a buildup of PLAF in the Cantova. All over the country, you were getting these reports of, but it was relatively small. You're talking about 100 men or 50 men or, you know, 1 ton of supplies and so on. What nobody did was to put this together and multiply it by 118 and see that. And yet, in retrospect, it was so simple. You know, you're going through these reports and you keep saying, why couldn't anybody see it? You know, why couldn't I have seen it? Because I had been reading these reports up to this point. But it was, I don't know what the moral of that is, but anyway, as to the shock, I think one thing about this, I think I also did a piece for Far Eastern Economic Review, one of these quickies in which I was trying to cover my behind, no matter what proved to be right, this would stand up. And what I said was that the perception of the Tet Offensive varied greatly among observers. And you can sort of divide these into three categories. There are those people who did not believe that this could happen. And if you would have put it to them and said in advance, is this going to happen? Let me describe it. They would have said no. Now that was most of the people in Washington, almost everybody in Washington. It was a lot of the press in Vietnam. Not all the press, but most of the press. And I'd say most of other observers around the world, both military and... Then there were those who would have said, well, this is... yeah, it could happen. Very well could happen. I don't think it's going to happen, but you don't rule it out. I was in that category, and I think most of the Americans in Vietnam, most of the Vietnamese were in that category. Then there, as I say, there wasn't really anybody who would have said, yes, I knew this was coming, yes, I predicted it was coming, and by God, it did come. I mean, we've never been able to find anybody like that who had a date. So the point is, though, if you did not expect this to happen, the shock and the trauma is much greater than if you thought that it was possible. So there was a great divergence between Washington's reaction and the reaction in Vietnam. And we couldn't understand what they were so totally upset about in Washington. You know, of course this could happen, and then now it's happened, so, you know, you roll with the punches and get on with the war. You don't have this... this absolute numbing psychological shock. Yeah, the reports of in the biographies of Lyndon Johnson by people who were close to him, Walt Rostow and other, was he simply did not believe it would happen. It was just mind-boggling to him that it did. Well, that given the case, you understand why people react or what would be appeared excessively in retrospect. As I say, there was an ironic quality to this failure. It reinforce the arguments of Jop's great doctrinal opponent Trung Chin, Because he could say that Jopp began this campaign with 195,000 men, and he had lost, killed, or permanently disabled at the end 85,000 of his very best troops, and he had nothing, virtually nothing militarily, to show for it. Yet he had disheartened, Trung Chin would say, he disheartened the Americans, he brought down the President of the United States. It was, Trung Chin would say, political Dao Chan at its very finest, and proof positive that you can win the war off the battlefield. At this point, Hanoi began a series of moves that had the net effect of changing the grand strategy from the doctrine employed these past 3 years to something that was resembling the pre-1965 days, which was later termed the neo-revolutionary guerrilla war, which we'll get into in the final lectures of the year of the war. That's a kind of truncated lecture on the Tet Offensive, 1967-68 winter-spring offensive. I have a feeling I'm forgetting some important points of this, but if you have any questions or any reactions, any comments. Yes?
Had Westmoreland contemplated before the Tet Offensive asking for the asking for more troops or anything along the lines of 200,000 troops, or is it...
Well,
he
had been asking for troops and getting them in increments not quite that big, but beginning, you know, when he in 65, I think there was probably 60,000 troops, and at the peak, at mid-68, it was 460,000. They had been going up steadily, and the notion had been really that by Washington, is whatever you need, Westmoreland will give you. And so he would ask for another 50,000 or another 70,000, he would get them. And this was the time when the decision was made not to give him any more.
And was right then and there, did militarily in Vietnam, our commanders there were told, like, to cut back, or did our military policy change much? Directly?
Well, I think it was seen that unless you get more troops, you can't win. I think the military saw. The critics of the military said, you know, you should be able to win with what you got. It isn't just a matter of more troops. Something else is wrong here. I think this was the thinking. But the standard military response would be to request for more troops, more guns, more everything. And expectation that that would do it, more bombing and so on. The history, I think the judgment on the winter-spring offensive, Tet Offensive, and the winter-spring campaign is still out. At the time, I think it was generally regarded as being simply an unmitigated defeat for the Allies, for the U.S., for the South Vietnamese, and a great victory for the North Vietnamese. Later, as a more sophisticated appreciation of the nature of the strategy involved developed, I think it was seen, I mean, now I think you almost have to look at it in terms of political Dao Chan and armed Dao Chan. And therefore, you can say, which appears to be, a contradiction, that this was a military, for North Vietnam, it was a military defeat and a political victory, and for the U.S. and the South Vietnamese, it was just the reverse. It was a military victory, and it was a political defeat. But if you accept the notion that there's no, you can't really divide these two, it's a seamless web, then I'm not sure what conclusion. It was both a victory and a defeat for both sides. It also was geographic, I think. The assessment in Vietnam was quite different from the assessment in the United States. I can't escape the feeling there's something else that I... Does this seem to satisfy you? There are no loose ends?
When you did wind down, what made it wind down? Did you start it or?
Well, it didn't wind down. I mean, what this lecture here will, we're taking it really only through 1968, for the last months of 68. And what happened after that was a switch to new strategy by both sides, really. As I've suggested, the not to telegraph this too much, but what the strategy the U.S. developed was simply to get out of Vietnam under the best possible circumstances. Strategy of the North Vietnam was to try to win, achieve unification, but not by big unit war, not by armed Dao Chan primarily, but to do it off the battlefield, either at Paris or in South Vietnam.
So there was a real lull in fighting on both sides?
Yes, it dropped off very, very sharply after that.
Was it a case of just our patrols going out? We just kept maintaining patrols out there and all? There just wasn't?
Well, no, there was activity. Again, I don't want to get into this too much because it's the subject of next two lectures, actually. But essentially what it was on the part of the North Vietnamese was the advent of what we called the super guerrilla concept or strategy. That is, it's a form of armed political Dao Chan, but it is not toe-to-toe confrontation. It's not big unit war. It's the notion that you can field a highly trained sapper units, which were the common unit, and you reverse the earlier image of the guerrilla was a farmer in black pajamas with a homemade shotgun. This was replaced with the so-called super guerrilla notion, that is, highly trained military units that are like professional football teams. Everybody, you know, knows exactly what they're doing. You just go in and you surgically take out some installation and you get out. You have the finest equipment that the communist world can supply. You have superb communication and explosive devices, transport, everything you need. But it's that's the concept of it. And that was Trung Chin's idea, basically. And he tried it through the next two or three years. It did a lot of damage, but it didn't achieve victory. That was Schaap's criticism, that it doesn't accumulate force enough. You go on these pinpricks bleeding the enemy, but you're being bled at the same time, so you're not that much further ahead. Well, I don't want to, yeah.
You said something at the very beginning of the semester, you know, the Tet Offensive made the NLF or whatever, and then you said that.
Yeah, right. That was what I wanted to say. There was only one major PLAF battle during the Tet Offensive, and that was at Hue. All of the rest of the particularly in the Tet Offensive, these small attacks throughout the country, these were almost entirely, they were entirely PLAF. That's one point. PLAF, not PAVIT. Second point was that they basically bypassed Americans and went after the Vietnamese, South Vietnamese. Those are two sort of key points to make about the nature of the Tet Offensive. Now, it was widely believed in South Vietnam, and then as a result, of course, the PLAF was just gutted. It was widely believed in South Vietnam by Viet Cong, that is NLF people, that this was done deliberately by the North Vietnamese, that the PAVN in the South just sat on their hands through the whole, the whole Tet Offensive, and while the PLAF was just being creamed in the cities, and that they were doing that deliberately because they thought victory was right at hand and they did not want this army of 120,000 loyal to the southern cause more than to the northern cause to be in place when the war was over, because there was a great danger then that they would not agree to unification and they'd wind up winning the war and losing the peace. Now, there's no evidence whatsoever to support this, but almost every Vietnamese I know tends to believe it. Partly it's a kind of this conspiratorial, clandestine, whatever it is, happens in Vietnam, it can't be what it appears to be. It's got to be something else. On the other hand, there is the possibility that this was a deliberate calculation on the part of Hanoi just to gut these Southerners. They were, you know, good soldiers and they helped us a lot, but now that victory is over, we don't need them around, and there could be a serious problem in future plans. As I say, I don't believe this, personally. I don't believe it sort of psychologically or emotionally, but more importantly, I don't believe it because there isn't any evidence to it. And the fact that there isn't any evidence does not necessarily mean it's not true, but it is one argument. It's always hard to prove a negative, of course. Anyway, the other aspect of this, which I think was political in orientation, was, in an odd way, did not work, but these NLF and Viet Cong and PLAF units, with a few exceptions, would go right around American installations on their way to somewhere else. Now, they did hit the American embassy, they hit the way, they hit, that was PLAF and Pavin, that was a different matter. They hit the Americans and Marines there on full scale, but that's the only place. Everywhere else, in Dalat, they went after the military academy, went around the American military advisors compound. Almost no place was there a direct assault on an American installation. Now this, of course, became immediately obvious to all of us in Vietnam. They are not going after the Americans. Of course, what does that cause Vietnamese to think? Aha, there's a deal going down. The Americans and the Hanoi have got some kind of a scenario in which they're going to. And a widespread rumor, every Vietnamese in town I knew was telling me that this is undoubtedly true. Next thing, Bunker calls and says, do you know about this? And I said, yeah, everybody knows about it. He said, well, I feel I should go on AFRS radio and deny it. I said, it's the worst thing you can do. I mean, you just give credence to it. Everybody knows it already, so the mere fact that you deny it is going to be have the worst effect. Well, I know, I'm sorry, I think it simply requires that I deny that this is a ridiculous idea, that we're in league with the communists. And so he went on radio and announced it, and all my Vietnamese said, aha, there is something to it, isn't it? He wouldn't have denied it if it weren't true. And so then he began, well, you think, my God, maybe there is something to it. Yeah. The story of the oil Wildcat oil man from Texas who died and went to heaven and was very bored sitting around there, because most of the other oil men had gone to hell. And so just for the fun of it, he started this rumor in heaven that there had been an oil strike in hell. So all the oil men that were there all went to hell. And he sat around for a while and thought, you know, maybe there is something to this story. And he went to hell too.
Was Nguyen Cao Cai in charge in Saigon at the time of the Tet Offensive?
He was mostly in the air. He was still primarily an air marshal. And,
was there sort of a main strong central figure at that point, as far as Saigon?
Yeah, it was Q and Key. It was a military directorate. There wasn't any. There wasn't any real. The attacks in Saigon were not of the sort that in Cholon, the Chinese city, they were stronger. The fighting went on there for several days. Mostly, it was fairly small units that were simply holed up and surrounded. And there was a reluctance to try to go in and wipe them out because you'd take high casualties, and better to try to wait them out and get them to surrender. But there wasn't a widespread, heavy fighting in Saigon. It was a kind of a, the anxiety level was fairly high, but there wasn't, there simply wasn't the fear that of massive enemy forces coming into the city and destroying it. Saigon up to this point had been almost immune from the war. It had gotten no military assaults to amount to anything. A few grenades and bombings occasionally, but those were more really to advertise the cause than to...
So just sort of to clarify something, I don't know if I got these notes right. You said that, I think Pavin was begun at the end of the Second World War by a small group of people, mainly in these caves in the highlands.
34,
and
right.
You said Jap and 33 other people. And I think you said at the time that he was at that time 72 years old, is that right?
No. He must have been born about 1910, I'd say. So,
long cry from the 70s. So he would have been in his late 30s.
Yeah. Well, one other thing about this, the last point, this, there was a political struggle dimension to the whole winter-spring campaign. And as I said earlier, the expectation was that in the at the final end, the last 3 months, you would get this koinia, this general uprising in which all of the people, all the civilians and the villages and so on would just rise up and throw off the government yoke and the revolution would be over. There was some of this. That is, there were some true believers in the cities, and even in Saigon, who really believed that this was the moment of general uprising, and they acted accordingly. In fact, the most startling of this, there was one main street in Saigon called Phu To, in which there was a kind of general uprising on one side of the street, but not on the other. And people actually came out of the houses and raised Viet Cong banners and were shouting and demonstrating, and all the neighbors on the other side were just looking out the window at this. And we never could really figure out how this happened. A lot of those people, of course, who sort of committed themselves, got out of town when it was obvious that the thing was not over. But it appears that a question we never were too sure of: did they really believe, did the leadership in Hanoi believe that all of the civilians in South Vietnam, or a large percentage of them, if given the opportunity, would rise up and join the cause? I mean, knowing anything about Vietnamese in general, you would say that's very unlikely. So the question is, did the leadership in Hanoi really believe this would happen, or was Koinia just a kind of useful mobilizational, motivational device? What we did know is that we would capture a lot of reports going from South Vietnam to the North about the conditions in South Vietnam, political conditions, evaluation of the system, and so on. And these were all very optimistic, upbeat, very much like, excessively so. To a condition not unknown on our side in our reports back to Washington about how well things were going. So, and these were from cadres in the South who were telling the North Vietnamese things that they wanted to hear, and probably, basically, which these people doing the reporting actually believed. They were just putting it on a little heavy, maybe, because partly it was their job to cause this condition to develop. So naturally, you're reporting on how well you're doing. You tend to lay it on a little thick or look for the best evidence. What it would emphasize, of course, was how was the rising tide of anti-Americanism among South Vietnamese. And they would give specific examples of this. And by and large, these were true. There was a kind of growing, as the more and more Americans came in, there was a more and more anti-American tendency tended to rise. But the point is that when this is at the village level primarily, that the villagers were increasingly anti-American, we'll say, but they were also increasingly anti-GVN and increasingly anti-Viet Cong and increasingly anti-everything else. So the notion in Hanoi that if they were coming to hate the Americans more, they're going to love the Viet Cong, more, simply doesn't follow. The villager is quite capable of hating everybody at the same time. Nevertheless, it appeared to create in Hanoi, particularly among Trung Chin and the people who stressed this the political Dao Chan most heavily, that conditions were extremely ripe for this general uprising in Koinia. And it was the hardest thing for American in the South ever to, in Washington, to take this Koinia business seriously. I did. I really did think that it was a very powerful mobilizational and motivational tool. And as I think I've said earlier, this was a social myth in the Sorelian sense, like the myth of the second coming of Christ or myth of the general strike. And it doesn't really matter whether it's going to happen or not. What really counts is whether people believe that it's going to happen, and they live out their lives on the basis of it happening. Remains one of the unresolved questions of the Vietnam War. Okay, anything else on the Tet Offensive? Or the middle years of the war?
What happened at Hue?